This episode is brought to you by AARP. 18 years from tonight, Grant Gill will become a comedy legend when he totally kills it at his improv class's graduation performance. Knees will be slapped. Hilarity will ensue. That's why he's already keeping himself in shape and razor sharp today with wellness tips and tools from AARP to help make sure his health lives as long as he does. Because the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/healthyliving.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey folks, Eddie Trunk here, and yep, it's time for another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is new every Thursday. Podcast1.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for listening. It is greatly appreciated. As always, the interviews you hear each and every week originated on my Sirius XM radio show, Trunk Nation, heard live on volume channel 106. Monday through Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time. Nightly re-airs, 10 to midnight Eastern. Anything you want, audio, video, on the Sirius XM app. If you're in the U.S. or Canada, please be sure to join me daily and come on board if you're not already for the daily rock talk show, Trunk Nation, on volume Sirius XM channel 106. All the interviews you hear here, just about everyone, originated there and aired live on that show. You're only getting a tiny fraction of what I do on a daily basis here on this podcast. Everybody else, thank you for checking out the show and the podcast. And remember to follow me on social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter and Instagram, where I am most active. And you can also catch me on the fan page on Facebook, simply at my name, and eddietrunk.com is the official online home. As I've got a cable tied up in my shoe. Hold on a minute. Oh, man, what a day it's been. I'm doing this on a Monday night after finishing up 5 hours of live radio on Sirius XM. So a little fried. And I got a cable coming off of one of my audio devices here that somehow got tied into the bottom of my foot, which is crazy. Anyway, what was I saying? At Eddie Trunk on social media, eddietrunk.com is the website. All access members of my site, you can get my terrestrial radio show on demand anytime you'd like. There's music news there for you as well. There's a merch store. Email is eddie@eddietrunk.com. That's all there on the website. So there you go. And I'm on Cameo as well if you're interested in a personalized video. Just search my name at cameo.com. You cannot order a Cameo video from me via an Apple device or app. You've got to go to the website, cameo.com, and do it that way. Thank you for doing so to all those who have requested the videos. So if you were listening last week, you know it doesn't get much bigger than being able to say Tony Iommi and Geezer Butler are your guests on a podcast. That's exactly what happened last week, as two founding members of Black Sabbath join me for a great conversation, which you hopefully heard, and if not, you can go back and listen to. This week, as promised, the two most prominent drummers in the history of Black Sabbath. First, the band's original drummer and one of the all-time greats, Bill Ward. Second, Vinny Appice. As I mentioned, I did a series of interviews with Vinny, Bill, Geezer, and Tony to talk specifically about the Dio era of Sabbath because of the recent reissues of the Mob Rules in Heaven and Hell. So last week I bought you Geezer and Tony. This week I'm bringing you Bill and Vinny. Now, of course, Bill was only involved in that era by playing on Heaven and Hell and doing a part of the tour for that record before leaving the band. And much of that is covered with Bill Ward. But originally, when I was doing that week of Sabbath Talk, Bill was not originally included. And as I talked to Tony, Geezer, Vinny, I quickly realized, you know, they were all talking about Bill. And I was like, maybe Bill would want to be involved in this. And he said yes. And that's why we have the interview that we had on the SiriusXM show. And of course, you're about to hear on the podcast. I've had a chance to do some interviews in the past with Bill Ward. He's a wonderful guy. Vinny Appice, I've known forever. Great friend, great guy, great drummer, both of them. And these interviews being presented to you this week, back to back, provide a really unique perspective. Now, timeline-wise, on the radio, the Vinny Appice interview aired first, and Bill Ward was second. I'm bringing them to you this week in reverse order, but it doesn't really matter. They're standalone interviews, but each of them talk about the other drummer, and I think you're going to find it fascinating. So get ready. It's an amazing couple of weeks when you can say, over the course of 2 weeks on a podcast, I'm bringing you three quarters of the original Black Sabbath along with Vinny Appice. That's tough to beat. So I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoy doing it. Without further ado, we'll come back and get into it with Bill Ward next.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
This is Denny Somach, host of The Rock Podcast. I'm a producer, author, and rock historian, and I want to share with you some of the greatest stories in rock and roll.
Well, Bonzo was the best hard rock drummer ever, hands down. I mean, no one comes within a mile of him.
And I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. John Lennon had this wise guy look on his face, just like me and my friends were just a bunch of wise guys, street kids.
The first guitar I ever had was Spanish guitar, and I couldn't really get the hang of it. I was only 13.
I had never written a song before, actually, and so Jim says, okay, everybody go home and write some songs, you know. And so I went home and wrote Light My Fire.
Join me for The Rock Podcast, the only podcast that matters, from Podcast One or wherever you get yours.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Eddie Trunk, and first up is Bill Ward, founding member of Black Sabbath, one of the all-time great drummers. Always an honor to have some time with Bill. You'll hear how our conversation went right now. Enjoy. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm very, very good. I appreciate you taking a few minutes out of your day to join us for this. I don't know if you've been made aware, but the entire week I've had Tony on, I had Geezer on, I had Vinny on the other day. We've been celebrating and remembering the Heaven and Hell period of Sabbath because they've reissued those records, as I'm sure you're aware. And I reached out because I would love to get your perspective and have a few minutes with you to talk about that period of time with the band, because your name has come up a lot throughout the conversations.
Yeah, no, I'm honored to be a part of it, so, you know. That's fine. Yeah.
Well, what
thank,
can
thank you?
Yeah, Bill. What can you tell the audience? Because as I was saying just before you came on, you know, people don't hear a lot from you about this particular period because, according to Tony And Geezer, obviously it was a tough time for you where you were at in your life with your sobriety and everything, but you did make the record. It also says, and they have said in the liner notes, that you were the guy that had to deliver the news to Ozzy. So I would imagine, although a brilliant record came out of all of this, it was safe to say it was a difficult time for you personally?
It was difficult in a number of ways. You know, my mother had died, and I missed Ozzy as much as I, you know, understood the idea of moving on. I still missed him a great deal, so I was dealing with the grief of that and the grief of my mom, and I was trying to focus on the new ideas that we had for ourselves with Ronnie, you know. And so moving through all that was pretty difficult, and I was drinking quite a bit as well. So I relied a lot on Tony for my cues. There were some parts which were quite orchestrated, actually, you know, in my opinion. I was kind of there, but sometimes I wasn't quite there. So, and it's difficult admitting that, but that's the truth of it, you know. So,
yeah, Tony had said, you know, I'm curious, did you know Ronnie prior to him coming into the band? Because Tony had said that he had met him at a party, and that was the connection. But did you have any history with him?
No, the only thing that I had ever heard was during rehearsals, Sabbath rehearsals with Ozzy, when we were in Monmouth, I heard what we call the bus sung, It's Rainbows, I've forgotten the name of the song. Sorry, Eddie, I'm
Man on a Silver Mountain?
Just time passes.
Man on a Silver Mountain?
Sorry?
Was the song Man on Silver Mountain, that song? You said it was a rainbow song.
No, it wasn't that. It was it's the one where Cozy did that brilliant, absolutely brilliant beginning.
Stargazer. Stargazer. Yeah, Stargazer.
Stargazer. Yeah, we call it the bus song. The reason why we call it the bus song is because when we were on tour in the early 2000s, that was the first record we played when we finished the Sabbath show, and I would get in my bus and we would put Stargazer on. So it stuck with me, and I heard Stargazer and I was so impressed by Ronnie's voice. You know, I knew he had, you know, it's quite obvious that he had, you know, all the chops and everything else. So that's how I met him. I met him musically through Stargazer.
Yeah, I mean, Tony also said that for him, he thought it was appropriate at that time to find a singer to come in that was very different than Ozzy. He didn't think it would have been appropriate to bring in somebody that sounded like Ozzy or acted like Ozzy. So he wanted someone that he could work with musically and that it would connect, but also that had a very different approach to singing and a different type of voice. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really aware of any of that kind of stuff, to be honest. I it's just like, put it in front of me, tell us what we're doing and I'll play, you know. So mine wasn't, the idea of the collaboration and how it ought to be and things like that was not something that was significant for me.
Did you, Bill, I know it was difficult for you to see Ozzy leave and to have to deliver that news, but did you feel it was the right thing to do at the time? I mean, the one thing that I've gotten this week from Tony and Geezer is that there was really, the one thing they felt really strongly about with Ronnie coming in was that there was a new enthusiasm. They felt that Ozzy had really just lost a lot of enthusiasm for the band. Were you on board with the decision at that time?
This will probably come out in the book. I didn't agree necessarily with the decision, but I could understand that it was the right thing to do. Sometimes there's a difference between you know, doing the right thing and doing the right thing, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And so I actually saw it more of the end of Black Sabbath as we understood it. And I thought it was a very dangerous move. That's how I felt about it. But I, you know, I'm a musician, and so I agreed to the idea of moving on. You know, I found Ronnie to be very friendly. We were pretty good mates, you know, so there was no problems like that, you know. And I showed up as a musician, moving into something new, and I did what I'm supposed to do, you know. I'm supposed to play drums and be helpful in any other ways that I can, and I tried to do that the best I could. But deep down inside, you know, I had a lot of reservations about the entire idea of moving on, because one of the guys was you know, was hurt in battle, you know, and he was having problems.
What are your thoughts about the Heaven and Hell record now when you listen to it and the material on it? Do you feel it still holds up? Do you like
the dynamics? I like the dynamics. I think it's great. I think we did some really good stuff. There's some songs which I don't really want to go down and, you know, in this interview and kind of like blah and, you know, push out each individual's, excitement or, you know, the way that everybody else felt. I don't want to, you know, say things that will be negative. If I haven't already said enough, that might be negative, because I don't feel negative towards it at all. You know, it's something that happened. We did it. Ronnie, I think, did a fantastic job. But musically, it wasn't my favorite album. I'll just say that. But I do like the dynamics that we did, especially in Die Young. I think that was dynamically. I think the band was excellent, and I think Ronnie was absolutely incredible. One of the songs that I like the most, Eddie, is "Lonely Is the Word." Mm-hmm. And I like it because it's a neutral song. It's a place that is like based in more or less a blues thing. Mm-hmm. And the commonality of that makes it more appealing for me, because it's neither coming from a Ronnie place or from a Tony place, but it's coming from a blues place. And that's the commonality, and it sounds so good. And Ronnie did an incredible a job on that, and so did Tony. I mean, the playing is just really, really good. I put that on occasionally and listen to it just for the nostalgia of it, you know, so I like that a lot. I thought Heaven and Hell was kind of like a Sabbath thing, how I understood the Sabbath to be. It's hard turning everything around on a dime within 6 months and be, you know, and suddenly turns into something else. But I think Ronnie very carefully and lovingly made that what would be a Sabbath song, in my opinion. I think he was very honorable on that record and in that song. And he had his own Ronnie lyrics, and he had his own Ronnie ways. But that worked. I thought that song worked really, really well. From three guys from Black Sabbath, and then Ronnie coming from Rainbow and other bands where he was coming from, and then putting that onto Heaven and Hell, I thought it was extremely well made. I think it was very, very well done.
As far as the tour, Bill, obviously it's been well documented. You left the tour somewhere.
Yeah.
They say you basically just disappeared. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I didn't. I couldn't when we went onto the stage, I really... I had a lot of difficulties playing Black Sabbath songs with Ronnie up front. Again, this is not a... I'm not talking about a personal affront about Ronnie. It just was so different and so difficult for me to accept and to be to think that that was the norm, you know. That was the new norm. Especially when we did songs like Black Sabbath and things like that. It's so I played them as best that I could on stage, but so I was having difficulty with that. I think my biggest fault was that I wasn't being honest with anybody at all. I was drinking more, and I wasn't being sincere. So, and I was so if anything, I was at fault by not being honest enough with everybody and saying I'm having a problem with this, you know. And I think that Ronnie, out of anybody, you know, would have said, you know, just say it like it is, Bill. Because that's the kind of person that he was and is, you know. So,
right.
So in that respect, that was one of the difficulties that I had when we were running it on the road, to the point where I that coincided for me where my drinking was I couldn't stop. I reached that place in my alcoholism where the drinking became more important than anything else, and I'd never crossed that line ever before in all the years of touring and everything that we'd done. I'd never crossed that line where booze became more important. And I crossed that line, and unfortunately I crossed that line, I believe it was in Indianapolis, and that was one of the worst things, I think, that there's quite a lot of worse things in my life. But that's one of my worst regrets, that I moved on. I couldn't even play the gig, and I moved on. And that was just absolutely appalling on my part. And it's a regret that, you know, I don't know how to repay anything or do anything about that. I've said enough sorries about it, and I've regretted it, but... you know, I just try my best to not ever do that again. You know, I've tried to. I've been living a different life for over 37 years now. So, and I hope that means something maybe to anybody that might be listening today. In terms of, I've tried to, you know, do things. I tried to make up for that when we did the reunion tours. I tried to play my ass off and give some credibility to everything for the mistakes that I did make.
Yeah, well, with you leaving the band, and then Vinny was on the other day, and of course he was the guy that they brought in. Vinny had an interesting take on things, because I had asked him about his relationship with you, and he said wonderful things, and he told a few stories, but he said that, you know, for him as a drummer, he was coming, he had a different approach. He said, you know, Bill... He described you as being a drummer, but also a percussionist. He said the way you played on the material was uniquely you. It was uniquely your style of playing. And he said it was a very different thing, and that he had to really work at doing the best to bring his style in, as well as doing the best he could to honor what you had done. And I thought that was a really interesting take from Vinny.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, Vin's a drummer, and I'm an orchestrational drummer. So Vin, you know, lays things down. Just listen to any Dio record, and he plays great on all that stuff. He plays fantastic. He's just, it's just really very straightforward. Everything hangs correctly, and it sounds how a rock drummer would sound. But I'm not a rock drummer. I'm an orchestrational drummer. And I play differently. If Tony plays a chord or a Geezer plays a bass note, I react to that completely differently. I don't start laying down chops or, you know, or start putting in a rhythm or things like that. I'm just simply not built like that. I'm not designed like that. And I probably never will be, you know. So, but I thought that, you know, Vinny, when he played, I know I've talked to Vinny about that, you know, where, you know, I've talked to a lot of drummers that have come in and sat in my drum seat. They all say the same thing, you know, how they've tried to, like, you know, alter their you know, alter their style of playing to fit in the more orchestrated pieces and the more, you know, there's a lot of jazz things in there too that I was doing. So, you know, so it's, yeah, it's there's a lot of guys that have sat in the drum chair and have been very very kind about, you know, my drumming and or appreciative of what I played. And
yeah,
but you know, the hi-hats on War Pigs was always a thing for everybody, I think, to play. So, which is cool, you know. It's like I'm, you know, but that's why I think it worked. You know, I think Black Sabbath worked with Ozzy and Geezer and Tony and me, and that worked. And there's something about that seemed to work. That was a thing. And everything else, I think, that happened after that worked and sounded different and become different, and it sounded good, you know, but it was just different.
Yeah.
It didn't have whatever that quality is that we have when the four of us do something together. It's a different thing. It's a different band.
Yeah. Well, no doubt. There's no doubt. To say it worked, it would be an understatement of the century, because obviously Sabbath worked with that version, that original version of the band. What you guys did and what you created is just enduring forever. So, Bill, before we get to what you're doing now and any update you'd like to give the fans, there was one thing I did think about that I never had a chance to talk to you about or hear you speak on. When you left Sabbath and you were out on the Mob Rules and you had left and not part of that, you ended up coming back to the band for the Born Again record with Ian Gillan. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that decision and your thoughts about that record?
Well, for me, fortunately, I was so I left in 1980 from Heaven and Hell, and just hang with me while I go for the Dateline. And I started getting sober in 81, 82, and in 83 I had some sustained sobriety. And I was invited to come and work with Ian and Tony and Geezer. And I missed them so much. I really missed the band. And so I said yes, and I felt confident because I had... you know, I was clean and sober, and it was completely different from Heaven and Hell in respect that I was completely sober. I showed up, I played every track sober, and it was just a whole different vibe completely. And I was in my very early sobriety at that point, but of course that ended up where again. Sobriety, part of being sober is about being honest, and the idea of a tour made me so fearful that I actually picked up that drink after I'd finished all the recording for Born Again. I enjoyed doing that thoroughly. Again, with Ian, it was great working with Ian, as it was with Ronnie, you know. I forgot to mention something, if I may. I wanted to let you know that when Ronnie, you know, had Dio, I became a huge fan. It's quite ironic that even though things may not have been perfect for me in Heaven and Hell, when we were doing Heaven and Hell, when Ronnie had Dio with Vinny and the other guys, I became a huge fan. I loved his music. And as I had done when he was with Rainbow. So it's something that's kind of a little bit twisted round, but
yeah.
I wanted to make sure I said that, you know. So Anyway, I'm done.
No, well, but just on Born Again, yeah, you didn't do the tour, but you did the record. And your thoughts on that record, because I've talked to Tony about that record. Tony was telling me yesterday, that he'd love to remix that record, but the tapes are missing. Nobody can locate the tapes. Mm. But that's an interesting record in the Sabbath catalog, because it was somewhat maligned at the time that it came out because of the sound of it or the cover or whatever the case may be. But as history has gone on, Bill, there's a lot of people that really love that record and feel that it was a really very cool, unique, heavy rock record. What are your thoughts about that record in general?
Well, I think it was very well produced. I think it was Robin Black. It was great working with Ian. I thought we did some really, really good songs. Being a fan, both as well as Ronnie, I've been a fan of Ian's. I was amazed by what he would do and where he would go. You know, being a singer myself, I would watch him in the studios and hang with him where he went from part to part, and it's like, and I would try to imagine where he was going to go next, and I couldn't believe where he would go. He would go to these unbelievable places that fitted so perfectly. I thought Born Again was from everyone. Geezer's bass playing, I thought, was exceptional. I like what I did. I thought Tony had so many great licks. Zero the Hero. I mean, just there was just so much on that album. I think my least favorite one is Trashed, but other than that, I loved that record. Just everything about it is. I think it was very grounded. It was grounded. It was English, not to sound elitist or anything. That's not meant to sound elitist. It was just, there was four English guys, you know, in there.
Right, sure.
And and everyone had come from a blues background. So it was so it had that commonality. So I think there was a lot of things that we had and in place. I think it's a really good album, and I think it's possibly overlooked by a lot of people who perhaps haven't really listened to it. Maybe I don't know. I'm not going to be the judge of what other people listen to. So.
I would completely agree with you that it's overlooked, but I don't think so anymore, because I think as time has gone on, time has an interesting way of perceptions of records that at the time maybe weren't so well received, but in retrospect are looked at as groundbreaking or important or influential in some way. And Bill, if I'm doing the timeline right, a few minutes ago you said that you have been sober 37 years, so congratulations on that. That would mean, if my timing is right, that around that time of Born Again, after you made the record, and it sounds like you fell off, but shortly after, you've been sober ever since. Is that accurate?
That's correct. I got sober on the 2nd of January, 1984. 2nd of January, 1994.
Wow, congratulations.
I marked my sober date as January the 24th, because that was the first time I could actually see anything properly. You know, I saw a newspaper and it said January the 24th, so I went, okay, we'll start from here, January the 24th. And and I put that as my sober date. So, in January 1984, yeah.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. That's fantastic. So how is your health now, Bill? What have you been working on? What can you tell the fans about? And how are you feeling these days?
I don't feel too bad. I wish I could get out and walk, to be honest, but I'm not going to do that. I'm playing air drums in the house, and I'm trying to really stretch my legs every day and try to, you know, got a right knee has a bit of a problem, so I'm, using a little bit of Tiger Balm on that and things, you know. But I could definitely use more exercise. Writing-wise, I'm writing like a demon. I can't stop writing. I'm writing music. I'm writing some books. I'm writing poems. I just completed a new song for Day of Errors. We have two records ready to come out from Day of Errors. We have one unbelievable album from BWB ready to come out. All this stuff is mastered. It's just been sitting there because we don't know how to get it out into the world. And there are we know the ways of getting it out into the world, but we're trying to find a way where we might actually be able to make some money, heaven forbid. And so, you know, we're not looking to make millions of dollars, but it would be nice to, you know, have some way of presenting a product and actually getting some kind of a payment for it. Sounds old-fashioned, but, you know, I actually believe in that.
No, and I agree.
Believe in
I
that
understand.
For other musicians as well.
Yeah.
So if that gives me a kick in the ass by some of your listeners, then I don't really care, you know, so they can do whatever they want. I know that people have to do whatever they want about that, so, but I'm just going to continue writing. I've gone back to the original album, and we're re-looking at that. I've gone back to When the Bow Breaks, and I've now made that into a triple album, and we're working on that. And we've got other albums from BWB lined up. We have a plethora of work, probably that could go on for at least the next 6 or 7 years. And for Day of Errors as well, I think we've got another 4 albums lined up for Day of Errors after these next for these two albums come out. So we've got it. Man, I tell you what, you know, when you're stuck
busy
in the house and you've got nothing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
You know, so I can't stop writing. I'm just, I'm not just crazy about writing.
Yeah, and that's been the trend, especially in the last year, of all the artists I've spent time talking to. It's the same thing. I mean, unfortunately, you can't do much more but record and write and be as creative as you can indoors. I think we're finally getting through that. I think we're finally going to be on the other side of it sooner than later, which is good news for everyone. And then we'll see where it goes. Did you mention earlier when you said something for the book and you referenced a book now, are you writing your life story? Are you doing an autobiography?
Yeah, I'm doing a book which is I've got one book completed, and I'd rather not name the title yet. But that's been complete for a while, and we do have a publisher for that. I don't know a date when it's going to be released. But the other book that I'm writing, I'm writing 2 or 3 other books. You know, I write all the time, so. Some of them are very personalized things. Some of them are sarcastic looks at life, and but I guess the biggest book that I'm writing is my biography, and but it's not like a it's not like and then you know, in 1968 we became famous and then we did this and then we did that. I'm trying to be as careful about what I'm saying in order not to harm anybody, the reader, or anybody else that I've ever made contact with in my life. And right in the front of the book, there's a great big notice to self, which is do not discriminate, or do not say undignified things about your fellows or anything else.
Right.
I'm not going to write a book about, so it's not going to be a dirt book. So that, I guess that puts me right down way below where everything else where the publishers or some publishers like it to be. I'm trying to write something that's dignified, right. And I spend more time. Actually, I was just writing only just the other day. In fact, it was yesterday. I was writing about just picking something up here. I was writing about my old Land Rover, and I don't know if anybody's interested in that, but you know, the old Land Rover that I used to drive, we had it on the farm when we had a farm, and I'm writing about just like details about that, and then I'll move. I love moving. It's almost still the same as orchestrational playing. I'll move from that into this, you know, what it was like to play in the sound waves with Giza on stage. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing to be in all the dynamics of an onstage show, and learning to let that be the norm. That was the norm for me. I worked inside sound waves on stage, and when the wind would blow the sound, I would lose the count. The wind would blow the sound off the stage, and it's just like, whoa, you know, where are we? So there's all kinds of things like that that are more pinpointed rather than all the other things about rock and roll, you know, like, you know, things that are, to me, that are distasteful now, and I have grandchildren. So I'm writing it more or less for the grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And so they can understand that I work with some great men, some great players, some great musicians. I've worked with so many good musicians. And I've, so far, and I still continue to do that. And so it's a book about, I hope it'll be a book about being honorable and being worthwhile to other musicians and to interested readers, period.
Bill, final question. Do you have any hope to be able to play live again, even, you know, with your own thing, or even are you comfortable with Sabbath being put to rest? I know you weren't part of the most recent run of shows, but you know, talking to Tony yesterday, I mean, he's been dealing with some health stuff. We know Ozzy's been battling some serious health stuff. You've had your fair share of issues. Do you think that it's fitting and right? Or, you know, Tony said he'd love to play again, but he could only see a one-off or something special. He couldn't ever see touring again. Where do you stand on playing live? And as far as the Sabbath legacy being done now, do you think that it's appropriate that it's done?
Well, I'm not done with Black Sabbath legacy.
Right, but I mean, so as a touring entity.
I haven't been done. I was made done, but I'm not done.
Right.
So the others might be done, but I'm not. But as far as being realistic about that, as far as touring with Black Sabbath, then, you know, I don't have the chops, and I don't have the ability to drive a band like that on stage. You have to be, you know, I have to be back at 60 years old to be able to do that. And as far as my own band, we're looking at how we can do shows live, both with both BWB and Day of Errors, you know, and I'll go and play with Day of Errors. I'll play drums with Day of Errors, you know, clubs, wherever we have to go, you know, to do that. So we've still got a very open mind, all of us, for working with Day of Errors live. I would love to do a studio album with Sabbath, with all the original members. So, and I don't know, you know, I mean, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, I'm just floating that out there. I haven't talked to anybody about that or anything else, but I'm not done. So the other three might be done, and I respect that. But no, I'm not done. I think as long as we all exist, and we're still breathing in air, I think we have every possibility of making some great music together.
Well, and I think you could say that just about any band, as history has shown, even bands that have done retirements and farewells, as long as they're drawing air, there's always that chance they're going to do a show or do some recordings at some point. And it's interesting what you said as far as playing live and driving a band like Sabbath live, very different than I would think what you just said you'd like to do, which is go in a studio and create new music that you feel you'd, obviously in a studio environment, it's not nearly as grueling as being on the road, that you would be up for that.
Oh yeah, I would love to do a studio album with Black Sabbath. Yeah,
right.
But I'm being honest, and I'll be 73 next birthday, and I know what kind of energy it takes to drive that band.
Well, I saw you a couple years ago in Los Angeles at that award show, and you looked great and sounded great, and you do now as well. And I greatly appreciate you taking some time and joining me this week, Bill. I wanted to be sure you were offered to be included, and I'm really glad that you took the invitation and had a chance to come on the air. And of course, you're welcome anytime to share what you're doing with Day of Errors or BWB or anything you have coming down the pike. We always want to know about it, and you know where to reach me. You're always welcome anytime.
Thanks, Eddie. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Take care of yourself, Bill, and stay healthy, yeah?
You too. You too. And next time I'm in L.A., when things start picking up again, I'll definitely hope to see you and spend some more time. All the best.
All the best. All the best, mate. Yeah.
Take care. Well, thanks to Bill Ward. Always great to visit with him. Great to get some insights from him about a period of time in Black Sabbath that, honestly, he doesn't talk about all that much, because he was only part of one record and part of one tour at that time. But what a record, Heaven and Hell. So it was really, I thought, very interesting to get Bill Ward's perspective and hearing him speak on something you don't hear him talk about all that much. When we come back, the drummer who replaced Bill Ward in Sabbath, Vinny Appice, next.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome back. Eddie Trunk here, as promised, as we bring you the Sabbath rhythm section this week on the podcast. Vinny Appice, who did the lion's share of the work with the Dio lineup of Sabbath. Here's Vinny with a great conversation. Enjoy. Vinny.
Hey, Eddie, how are you?
I'm good. So before we even get into some Sabbath talk here, just a few minutes ago, before you came on the air with me, I got a text from our mutual friend, Frank Bello from Anthrax.
Yeah.
And he writes to me, Eddie, I hear you got Vinny on today. When you talk to him, ask him the story about the lasagna pan. What is the story about the lasagna pan? What is Frankie talking about?
Okay, he's talking about when I was 16 years old, I wound up playing partly with John Lennon. And that happened because my band was managed by the Record Plant Studios in New York City, where Lennon recorded. A good friend was Jimmy Iovine, and he brought us in there, and we had a room to rehearse every night, you know, because we were managed by them. And John used to record there, and then one night they called us down to do hand claps. Jimmy called us up in our room and said, can you guys come down and do hand claps for a song? He didn't say who it was, so we said, sure. We go down, and we walk in the room. There's John Lennon. I go, oh, my God. Look who's John Lennon. So we put the headphones on. Now he's talking to us in the headphones. And it's like, oh, my God, this is like a dream, you know? So we wound up doing hand claps on Whatever Gets You Through the Night. And then he found out we were upstairs, and he used to come out upstairs and watch us rehearse, and we sit and talk, smoke a joint, and we got on the subject of Italian food. I was sitting there with John, and I told him my mother makes the greatest Italian food. My grandmother's from Italy. So we talked about it, and then I said, you know what? I'll have my mom make you some, and I'll bring it in. So a couple of days later, I brought in a pan of lasagna that she made for John, and I gave it to him. And he was very thankful, and he took it away. And then about a month later, my brother Carmine was playing with Rod Stewart. They were doing Madison Square Garden. They were at a party. about, you know, for the gig. And my parents went. My mother, Mary, and Charlie went. And John Lennon was there. So my mother spots John Lennon and says, oh, there's John Lennon. I want to go say hi. So Carmine brought him over to meet Lennon. And he explained that that's his mom and my mom, and she made you the lasagna. And my mom talked to him for a while. And then after the conversation, she asked John if he had the pan.
I knew that's where this was going. I could feel it.
Yeah, she's from Brooklyn, you know. There's no...
No, I'm telling you, I'm laughing so hard because, you know, I'm half Italian, but I might as well be 95% because I was brought up in that completely, and I totally could tell where you're going because my mom and my aunts would have done the same thing.
Right? It's that New York, Brooklyn, especially that era, generation.
Yeah.
It's like, doesn't matter, you're in the Beatles. You got my pan.
Yeah, those pans are sacred. There's like, what's burned into those pans is like legacy. It's like legends and passed down. And I remember my aunt had one that was like white, but it was like chipped, you know, on the side. But it was the pan, you know. You had to have it in the pan. You got to get the pan back.
Yeah, there's oil in the pan. You know, this was metal, so there's all that oil from years of cooking lasagnas and Italian food. And there was no, you know, so she asked him for the pan, but we never got it. So it was funny. You know, it was really funny. We think Yoko has it, but who knows?
That is so good. And if anybody in my audience that is, you know, grew up like I did and Vinny did in a dominant Italian household, that is so spot on. To this day, yeah. If my mom, who's like 80 years old, if my mom sends me food to have in like within 24 hours after having it, I haven't even had it yet, she's asking me, you bring the pan back? You got the pan?
That's great.
It still goes on.
Those are like the tools, you know?
Yes.
The Italian tools.
Yes. It's like people who make wine, the barrel has a certain thing. You got to have that barrel. It's the pan. Oh my God, that's the best. I could just see.
It's almost like the guitar players go, man, this is the guitar. You know, this one just feels right. You know, you got to have that guitar. And this is a pan, you know?
Yes. We got pans. My aunt and my late aunt and my mom have pans that I swear to God have been under that cupboard for three generations. But that's the pan. Yeah. So I could see your mom. God, that's priceless. That is so good. Oh, man,
yeah,
that's funny as hell.
It's a story that I actually forgot about that story. And then a while ago, maybe 6 years ago, Carmine and I did an interview with somebody in New York. And the guy remembered the story, and I went, oh, man, I forgot about that. That's correct. She asked for the pan back.
And knowing Bello like I do, I understand why he loves that story so much, because he's such a ball buster. He would love that. So I understand him eating that up.
He was cracking up. Yeah, he was on his. He was almost on the floor. He loved it, you know.
Yeah, he would certainly.
I did a little show with them last night. It was cool. Good.
Yeah, he would certainly relate to that for sure. So anyway, man, we've been celebrating these records, and we're continuing to do it all week. Let me ask you this. Have you had a chance to see or hear these two new reissues of these records?
You know what? I was smart. I called Rhino. They sent me a couple of copies of each, and I didn't get to listen to it yet, but I did look through it, and it's a really nice, beautiful package. And it's got, when you open like The Mob Rules, it opens up. It's like almost like a double album. And it's all the liner notes of all the stories we each told about making that record. And especially the song The Mob Rules. So it's a great package. I'm hoping to listen to this probably later tonight. And to hear the live tracks and the remastered, to hear how it sounds compared to the original. So it's a great package.
Rhino always does great stuff with their packaging, so this is no exception. And you're further ahead of the game than Geezer was on Monday, because Geezer didn't have a clue on Monday.
I heard he doesn't have a copy or anything, you know. And normally I wouldn't either. Then I thought, you know what, the guy that's booking all the interviews, Chip, I said, should I call Rhino to get some copies of this or what? He goes, yeah, that's, you should probably do that. I did, and they sent a nice bunch of copies out to me.
Well, let me get your thoughts, you know, about this time. You know, we've revisited this a number of times, especially over the last 15 years since the band got together for the third time. And obviously for you coming into this, this is where most rock and heavy rock fans first saw and heard you play. And I know, because Geezer told some of the story on Monday, you came in a pretty, you know, interesting way, in that in the middle of the Heaven and Hell tour, Bill just doesn't show up. So give everybody the story on how you got the call to join Black Sabbath.
Well, I'll even go a little further back, as it's interesting, because about a month before, I got a call from Sharon Osbourne, and she wanted me to possibly fly to England and meet Ozzy and maybe join his band. She was putting a band together with him. And then, but I was like 20 years old, you know, I haven't really been out of the country and going to England. Like, wow. I've been to Canada at that point, but that not England. And so I actually turned that down, because I talked to Carmine and I asked him, is Ozzy like legit? Is he crazy? Is he? And Carmine knew him. And he said, he's pretty nuts, you know? So I kind of just thought that was not the right thing for me right now. And I turned that down. Then a month later, I get a call, and it's Black Sabbath. I went, wow, what a year. So the call was to go meet Tony at the hotel. He was in California, in Hollywood, and I was there, so it was easy. So I went down to meet Tony, and we really hit it off well. And he had an album called Axis, that was a band I was with, a Pala trio. And he liked it. He liked the drums, and so, you know, we were off to a good start, and we hit it off. Then he invited me down the next day to play with the band. And about a week before, I heard Neon Nights on the radio, and I was like, wow, that sounds great, man. That new singer, Dio, is amazing. The band sounds great, you know, because I really didn't follow Ronnie that much back then. I heard Rainbow a little bit, but I wasn't a Rainbow fan. So I heard Neon Nights, and then when Tony invited me down, I went down, I met Geezer, Ronnie, and Jeff Nichols, a keyboardist, and they said, what do you want to play? I said, well, Neon Nights, because I knew the tempo, and there's only one stop in the song. So it's a good way to cheat your way through the song. You know, there's not a lot of stops or tempo changes and things like that. So that's the first song I played together with them and Ronnie, and it was the last song we played with Ronnie. 30-something years later at, Atlantic City. So That song had a pretty long journey. And then they said, okay, you're in until Bill comes back. I said, okay, great. So I had to learn the whole set, and we only had 3 more days to rehearse, you know. And it wasn't much time, especially that we played a couple more songs. Then they went to the pub to celebrate. They found a drummer, and that left less time to go over the song. So I stayed there with Jeff, and we went over, you know, listening to the songs. He lent me his Walkman, the cassette Walkman back then. So it was a lot of stress, and all I did was listen to those songs and make notes and cheat sheets and to get through it, you know.
So you were told, but Vinny, you were told initially that it sounds like you were initially told you were going to be temporary and that they were expecting Bill to return.
That's right, because they said it was under the circumstance of, well, Bill returns, you know, Bill, it's Bill's band. And so I, you know, I'm 20, 21. Yeah, this is a good opportunity here. So I said, fine. And then we did the first gig. Everybody was really nervous. We were really nervous. All my cheat sheet and book, it was in Hawaii at Aloha Stadium, and it was rain. It started to rain, and it blew onto my book, and my book got all shriveled up, and the ink ran. And so halfway through, the notes were useless, and we just had to wing it, and we did. And Tony, I heard, was really, really nervous, because he never played with another drummer up to that point. And it was always Bill.
So, neither would Geezer, I would think. I wouldn't think Geezer would have either. Yeah. And that's the rhythm section. Yeah.
Right. They always play with Bill. So here's this new kid on the block coming in. And I had a little drum set, which Tony was really concerned about. You know, the kit was small. And Tony even asked me if I play double bass. I said, no, but I'll add to the kit. I called Ludwig, and they sent me all these other drums, and I made it bigger eventually. So, yeah, so it was under the if Bill comes back, then I would go home, you know. So we started the tour and finished the Heaven and Hell tour, and Bill wasn't coming back. There was no word of it. And then finally we hit the UK, and we had to do a song for the movie Heavy Metal. So we had a couple of days off, went into John Lennon's house, which was owned by Ringo, because John
looking for the pan. Already. You're looking for the pan.
Yeah. And
you're at John Lennon's house. Your mom, I'm recording at John Lennon's house. Find the pen.
You know, I did look in the closet, but I didn't find the pen. Yeah. But it's so weird. It was like, okay, now we're going to record in this big English mansion. So we go in and they give us keys. And for some reason, I got John's room, you know?
Oh, wow.
And I just felt weird about staying there because he just passed. And, you know, I was like, yeah, I don't know. So I took another room, I didn't want to feel funny about it, but I took another room. And that's where we wrote and recorded The Mob Rules, the first take for the movie. So it came out so good. Like, Warner Brothers loved it. The band loved it. Tony, Geezer, Ronnie, they were freaking out. Then I knew that cemented me into the band more, you know, because now we recorded something. And Bill never plays somebody else's parts. He never had to. So if Bill did come back, are they going to do that song and he's going to play my parts? So it was interesting, you know, but I just felt a little more confident that I was in the band after we recorded that. So that's what happened.
Did you ever meet Bill Ward back then?
I met Bill Ward after that tour, you know, came back. I lived in L.A. and went to the Rainbow Bar and Grill, sitting there with my wife. And I said, there's Bill Ward. Oh, my God. Let me go over and say hi. But that's when Bill was drinking, and it was pretty wild. You know, he was pretty loose, let's say. I'm being nice. So I went over, and he started hugging me, and this whole big thing started happening. And then went, okay, time for me to get out of here. You know, and I felt very uncomfortable. I didn't want to get into anything. He was nice, but it was just really a little bit, a couple of drinks into it, you know. So I actually left. I said, let's go. And then later on, I met Bill a couple of years later when he was straight, stopped drinking, and he took care of himself. And he's the sweetest guy in the world. And I've met him many times thereafter, and we always got along great. And he's a real sweetheart, you know.
So, yeah, well, the condition he was in at that time was probably what led him to, you know, bailing on the tour. You know, I thought about this, Vinny, and this is pretty interesting. So Geezer, when he was on with me Monday, was telling me that he almost didn't make this lineup himself because he left during the recording of Heaven and Hell to go back to England because he was dealing with a really rough divorce. And he was not sure he was ever going to return or return to the band. And then he did just in time to record the bass. Then you've got Bill in the condition he was in at the time. And then, you know, he makes it through doing the record, but then he bails on the tour. Tony could have been in a really, really rough position there. As it was, he's trying to introduce a new lead singer. He could have found himself in a situation very easily, judging from what I'm hearing, where he was the only guy from Sabbath, because if Geezer didn't come back, there would have been a new bass player, and Bill was half out the door. So there's a big difference in trying to reintroduce Black Sabbath with this great new singer, Ronnie James Dio, than there would have been, hey, we're doing Black Sabbath, and I got a new singer, a new bass player, and I got a new drummer. I mean, that would have been a much harder sell. And it was really teetering on that happening, it sounds like.
Yeah, it could have been a bad situation. You know, it wouldn't have been the authentic Black Sabbath with a new singer, you know. So, and plus, nobody would have been on the Heaven and Hell album. I wasn't on it. And the bass player might have been on half of it. I know they worked with some other bass player for a little bit. and then Giza came back. So you're right. It could have been that road that it went down. But luckily, you know, Giza stayed in there. And I think what saved it, too, was when they came back to L.A., they found me quick, you know, and it wasn't like they had to cancel another bunch of weeks of the tour to find somebody. As soon as they got to L.A., I got the call. I went down and bam, you know, we got together and we were able to keep the rest of the gigs in place. And then for the first week, or actually 2 weeks, all I did was study those songs and get them as best and tight as we can, you know, and use Bill's parts, play the important parts that Bill played in those songs. So, so it wound up being people accepted it, you know. It was easier to accept a new drummer than a new singer, you know, because at that point on that tour, Ronnie would have those banners in the front, "Where's Ozzy?" You know, all that stuff he had to do.
Right. Right. Yeah, I talked to Geezer about that too, because when we were talking about the Mob Rules period, I had said to Geezer, I would imagine at that point, then Ronnie had been in for a while. People had already heard how great the music was he was doing. People knew he was the guy at that point. And there, I would think that on the Mob Rules tour, and I mean, you did some of the Heaven and Hell tour and of course all of Mob Rules, but I would think that it would be easier for Ronnie to be accepted by the time of the second record and tour. Cause at that point, everybody knew he was there than maybe on Heaven and Hell.
Oh yeah. And plus Heaven and Hell, you know, was a big selling album and what an incredible album, you know, no less the singing on it. So he was definitely accepted in as a member of Black Sabbath with, you know, a little bit of a different sound to it. But the first tour, you know, I did half of the Heaven and Hell tour pretty much, but he had to deal with all that stuff, you know, like, "Hey, where's Ozzy?" And you know, people just acting like that. There's always going to be somebody, you know, doing something stupid. Yeah. You know?
And when you joined Sabbath and came in on the Heaven and Hell tour after Bill left, was it still the Black and Blue tour? Were you still playing with Blue Oyster Cult?
Yeah. It was Blue Oyster Cult. And it was other bands too. I think the Black and Blue tour was just a segment of the tour. You know, we did I don't know how long that was, but it was in the Heaven and Hell tour. It wasn't the whole Black and Blue. Wasn't the whole tour from what I remember. But so we were doing that too. And then they filmed a movie and all this stuff. So it was quite a tour.
Tony talks in the liner notes to this new issue of Heaven and Hell about how he was worried that your drum kit was so small, which you mentioned before. Why was your kit so small at that point? Were you not prepared to be in Sabbath, or is that what you just preferred playing?
Well, as you could tell, like, I get a call one day. I mean, the kit I had was 4 tom-toms, but they were concert toms, which means they don't have a bottom drum head on them. So that makes it even smaller. You know, and I was playing with my band Axis, and I actually before that played them in Derringer, Rick Derringer, but we played clubs. So the kit was perfect for that, and I could fit it in my 67 Mustang back then, and it worked. So you got to figure, I get a call, and the next day I'm in Black Sabbath. Of course I'm not prepared that way. You know, it's like, the first thing Tony said after we played, "Can you play double bass?" I said, "No, but let me call Ludwig." And then I got aerial toms, which are up in the air, and another couple of 4 toms, and I made it bigger. And then it's his fault, because if you've seen the Heaven and Hell tour we did in 2009, I had this giant kit, 21 pieces, 21 drums. And that's because it got bigger every year. And then when we got together again, it got bigger and bigger, and that's Tony's fault.
That's
Tony,
great.
I didn't know he was freaked out that much. He goes, "Man, we got all these stacks of amps in this little puny drum set, you know?" And, wow, it's crazy. There was actually one gig on the Heaven and Hell tour in 1980 where this was a good one, too. We're playing arenas. Everything's moving along. I'm getting in the swing of things. And Bill's tech I either refused to set my drums up or left. So I had to set my drums up for the arena gig. Isn't that? I'm like, oh my God, you know. So that's when that changed too. I got my own tech. But
right.
Yeah, you know, he was loyal to Bill at the time. He felt weird working for me, and I was way younger than him, and so that's what happened. So crazy stuff on that tour.
Yeah, yeah. A few more minutes here with Vinny Appice. As all week, we are celebrating the re-release of The Mob Rules and Heaven and Hell in deluxe reissues from Rhino, which are out now. Again, Geezer Butler was on Monday. If you missed that, it's on the app. And Vinny with us now. Tony Iommi with us tomorrow as we continue talking Sabbath with Vinny right now. So, Vin, you know what I find interesting? You met Ronnie James Dio for the first time in Sabbath when you got there, and of course it started a long friendship and playing with him, obviously going on to Dio with him and everything else. So you didn't know him prior to Sabbath, huh? I'm kind of surprised by that, given that he had a history in music, and of course even at that young age you did as well.
Like I said, Rainbow was a band that was really big in Europe, but not quite as big in the U.S. So I was listening to Zeppelin and Hendrix and things like that. And I've heard Rainbow, and I've heard of Ronnie, especially that the name Dio, you know, in Italian means God. And I was like, wow, that's a cool name. But I didn't follow him. So I didn't really know his whole history. You know, I knew Long Live Rock and Roll, Man on the Silver Mountain, but I didn't really follow them, you know. Same with Sabbath. Sabbath, I heard all the music, and I wasn't a big, huge fan of Sabbath. I was a fan, but I was more of a fan of Zeppelin, you know. And probably the reason for that was the drum sound. The drum sound on the Sabbath records were really dead-sounding drums. Bill Ward's drums on his first couple albums, very small, but effective, you know. It was a great sound to fit the album, but I was into more what Bonham was doing with the big room sound and the big drum sound, because my brother was doing more of the big drum sound as well. So I liked drums that were sounding big and noisy. So that's why I didn't catch on to Sabbath like I should have. But and when I first heard it, I thought it was the scariest thing I've ever heard. My friend played me the first album. I went, oh, my God. And then I looked at the pictures and I went, oh, my God. And the names, you know, Ozzy, what's Ozzy? That's somebody's name. Even Iommi was kind of menacing the way it's spelled. And, you know, so when I met Ron, all of a sudden it's like, we hit it off, you know, like he's from New York. He's 15 years older than I am, but we hit it off and we liked the same kind of food. And all of a sudden we were like, we got a lot of things in common. Whereas Tony and Geezer, I couldn't understand what they were saying because they're from Birmingham with a heavy accent. And I've never been out of the country really, or around a lot of British people. And they would talk and I'd be going, oh, man, I'd ask Ronnie, what did they say? So he
translated.
Mentor, you know? Yeah, he translated for me, and they got a kick out of it. And then eventually, obviously, I got to get used to how the accent worked and how they thought and how it worked. And it was smooth, you know, but it was really funny. I couldn't understand them, you know, like, what? So, luckily, Ronnie, you know, was so nice and took me under his wing. If he was an asshole, it would have been a hard thing to be doing, you know, like, you know, not understanding Tony and Geezer. And then if Ronnie wasn't very nice, it would have been a little bit uncomfortable, you know, but everybody was great. And it was just felt right, you know, and it got better and better.
Do you feel that, it's interesting hearing you talk about your feelings about Sabbath and your awareness of their music prior to you joining the band, because not only are you trying to learn at the time this new album, Heaven and Hell, for the tour, but it sounds like you probably needed a crash course in the old songs they were still playing from the Ozzy era at that point. How did you attack that, and how did you interpret what you wanted to do with all of that material until Mob Rules had been by Bill? So were you just looking to be totally faithful to what he played, or as a drummer, did you try to, you want to put a little of your own stamp in it as well?
Well, that's a good question, because Bill has a unique style, and we're two different drummers. You know, I'm a different drummer than Bill. Bill always said he was a percussionist. And if you listen to those first couple of albums, there's like percussion parts in it. And, you know, I got to give you credit. That's very creative, coming up with drum parts like that rather than playing right straight through it. Anybody could play straight through a part. But to come up with a cool drum lick or maybe a tom thing, that's more creative. And that's what Ringo did. That people think Ringo's not very good, right? Listen to those parts on those albums. They're fantastic, you know? So I had to listen and listen and listen and learn those songs. And then I kind of took the main parts that Bill did and copied them. And then I put myself in between. So it was a little of both. So they felt comfortable. Tony and Geezer felt comfortable on that old stuff. And I could not have to worry about every single little part, you know? And then I adopted myself into it, how I would play it with those important parts intact. And that worked. It seemed to work good. But those old albums, the tempos change, the time signatures change. You know, there's some things in there that you count 1, 2, 3, 4 and a half and it comes in. You know, and that's because they played together since they were young, Tony, Bill, and Geezer. And they're like, they play as one. And it could be whatever timing or tempo it is, and they just knew how to do it, you know. So I had to adopt to that, but I did learn how to play more laid back playing with them.
Yeah, you know, I imagine Mob Rules, it's a whole different ball game then, because by then you've got some experience, some comfort level around these guys, you've got some live shows under your belt. Then when you go in to make that record and do the tour for that, I imagine it was a way more comfortable thing for you.
Yeah, that was time to rip. That was like, all right, now I'm going to rip it up. But I still kept in mind that I'm playing with Black Sabbath. And, you know, I'm not going to do too many crazy things. I'm going to lay it down. There's even ways I played accents that sounded very Sabbath-like. Instead of using a snare drum, I might have just used the cymbals. There were certain things I adapted that made it sound a little darker, which is what I wanted it to sound like with them, because it still was Black Sabbath, and kept it locked in, a little behind the beat, you know, and it seemed to work really well. But it was definitely time to rip it up a little bit. Now I could play more like me, put more energy into it, and kick the band in the ass a little bit, you know, because that's usually what I do, is kick the band in the ass from what I'm told. You know, so because I like to play hard and I like to play loud. So that's what I did, you know, and I just kept my style more on the dark side and made it fit, you know. And they never said anything like, maybe you shouldn't play that, or, you know, maybe once in a blue moon that was said by anybody. They let me do my thing. They had trust in me. And I used to play, you know, sometimes over the vocal line. Ronnie never said anything, you know, especially in Holy Diver. I'd play all over the place, you know, the vocals. He inspired me. I'd go crazy when he's hitting a note, and I'm like, ah! Ronnie never said, hey, don't play over my vocal line. So they really let me do anything I wanted. So luckily I took the right approach, you know, kept it to on the dark side, and it fit in, you know, it fit in well. So.
Do you have a favorite track on Mob Rules?
I like Turn Up the Night, and I like Mob Rules. I like them all, but Turn Up the Night's really cool. I like that song, and of course Mob Rules. Mob Rules just sums it all up, you know. Such a ripping song.
And I always thought Sign of the Southern Cross was the Mob Rules Heaven and Hell. I always thought they're very similar to me in their epicness.
Yes, yes. Well, the speed, the tempos are similar, and it was very, very heavy, you know, and you could hear those chords that Tony, the way Tony plays chords is like no other, nobody plays, could hit the same chord as Tony and let it sound like Tony sounds. You know, there's just something the way he plays, his little vibrato, it just sounds evil, you know. And that song was like heaven and hell, wide open with a big bass drum sound in there from Martin Birch and Ronnie's voice over that. It was incredible. So
you know another track on Mob Rules that I thought was really cool and has a really interesting drum pocket in it is Slipping Away, a song that's more of an album cut people don't talk about, but I always thought that was a really cool showcase for you. I love the way you play on that track.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's an interesting song because the rhythm, it's almost a little funk to it, you know?
Yeah.
R&B to it. And I was following Geezer on that, and that's what felt right. And it really worked, you know, but it was an unusual song. It's not a straight ahead 2/4 drum beat or that kind of rhythm. It's more of a funky thing, you know, and it worked well, you know. So I came up with that just following the bass, and we locked in, and then the rest just came naturally, you know. So.
And another sleeper on Mob Rules that I absolutely love is the last track, Over and Over. Ronnie's vocal is just ridiculous on it. And then you've got, so because it's more of a bluesy, slow thing, when you put fills in there and stuff, it just takes up, you know, I'm like you, I love big drums. It's just so big and loud and full. And it just,
yeah.
I love that track. That's one of those songs that, both songs, Slipping Away, Over and Over, songs that people, definitely album tracks that you don't normally hear, but just great, great records and great songs. And Over, to me, is just epic. I just love the sound of that. And Ronnie's voice is unreal on that.
Yeah, Ronnie's like, he's pouring his heart out in that song. And it's just unbelievable the way he could sing like that. And Over and Over is more like less is more, you know, like for drums, not too many fills, but when you do them,
yes,
they're big and huge.
Yes.
And just brings it to the next part. You know, it's more of locking in because it is like a blues song. And I love playing that song. That was a great song. We never did it. I don't think we ever did it live. You know, we didn't do it, but we all loved it. We all loved it. But it's an unusual song, too. It was like that kind of feel and a blues thing going on with Black Sabbath. So, but it all worked.
Hey, what are your thoughts on the Live Evil record? Because it was a controversial record, and in the sense that people say it led to Ronnie leaving the band and fighting over the mix and all that. As the drummer in the band, what were your thoughts about that record?
Well, you know, I was the new guy on the block, the low man on the totem pole. I just went along with whatever, you know. So what happened was we recorded the live stuff and we were set to mix it. I believe it was at the record plant in Los Angeles. And that's where Ronnie and I live. And it was scheduled to start in the afternoon. And Ronnie lived close together. So it was like, well, let's ride together, you know. We always did that, Ronnie and I. So we rode down to the studio. And then Tony and Geezer weren't there at that time. So Ronnie waited around, but he doesn't like to waste time and stuff. So he wanted to start getting a leg up on the mixes and this and that and this and that. And that got blown out of proportion to, like, when Tony and Geezer got there, they wanted to change things. So I can't really say what exactly happened. But they weren't happy with each other, you know. So I'm in the middle, like, okay. But Ronnie's always like that. You know Ronnie. He's not going to go and sit around waiting very long. He'd think, well, let's get something done. Like maybe get the drums up and see what they sound like. And so really, he wasn't trying to mix it himself, put it that way. He was just trying to get a leg up on what was going on. And then when Tony and Giza got there, everybody puts their input in. But I think things were bad, a little bit rotten at that time. So it didn't work as planned.
And I imagine, Vin, that was probably around the time, especially you guys are getting close, riding together to the studio. Was that around the time that he talked to you about, I'm going to go do my own thing, you want to come and do Dio?
Well, you know that he had that record deal in place with Sabbath. He was planning on being in Black Sabbath, and then he was going to use that record deal to start a solo record. And he was going to have all his different friends, musician friends, play on it. It wasn't going to be a band because he was in Black Sabbath. But as it progressed and things were getting not so cheery around Sabbath, he thought, you know what, I'm going to decide to put my own band together. So we were at the Rainbow again, and that's when he said to me, look, sitting there in the booth, and he turned to me, he said, I'm going to leave the band, and I'm going to put a new band together. Would you like to join me? And I said, yeah, absolutely. How exciting, you know, to be working with somebody that is like a brother and this great singer and something new. And he's in, right, you know, we live close together. So I thought it was a good move to do that. And, you know, Sabbath, they wanted me to stay with them. But I just thought this would be easier to do something new. I'm young. This is probably a time to do it. And Tony and Giza were in England, so I just made the choice of I'll do it with Ron, you know. And then when they brought in
Ian Gillan, they had talked to you about wanting to stay at that point.
No, this was right after Ronnie left. I don't think there was any talk. There was no talk of Ian Gillan yet. This was fresh,
right?
I don't remember Ian Gillan's name popping up. So, right. So I don't know. I think it was a matter of me just at that point going, look, I'm going to stay with you guys if you want me, you know. And then what are we going to do? But I didn't hear Ian Gillan. I think this was before, you know, before all that.
Hey, I only got about 3-4 minutes left before I have to end, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about what's going on with you now because you always got something cooking. Are you working on a new Last in Line record? Where are things at with you musically right now?
We got half the album pretty much done, and we're working with ideas across. We're a band that has to be in a room together, so it's hard to, you know, send files back and forth to create something now. But we're doing that. We're doing with we got a cover song in mind that we're working on, and then we'll get together soon and finish the rest of the record. And we're going for a new label as well. Got a label that's going to. It looks like it's going to happen. And then we got some dates coming up. We're waiting to see what Def Leppard's schedule is. You know, we don't know what's going on yet exactly with the big stadium tour. We don't know what they're going to do this year because we usually play in between Viv's schedule with Def Leppard. So right. We'll wait and see. But we have dates in October so far. And then if we open up, we do some maybe in the summer. Who knows? I'll have to wait and see, you know. So I've just been doing a lot of online stuff, which is cool.
Yeah, I think in terms of playing, I think what we're seeing is I think as much as I hope it happens for everybody, I think it's highly unlikely that stadium level tour is going to be able to happen as soon as June, which is when they're supposed to kick off. I just don't see any way that happens that soon. So
there's no sports event. So how could you all of a sudden put a big rock show on?
Right. I think everybody realizes, I mean, just like last time, it's pretty unlikely it probably gets kicked into next year or late this year in warmer climates. I don't know, but that's a good thing for Last in Line because for guys like Vivian who have a side band that plays at a club level, you can go out and play. That's going to clear some time, so that might be a great window for you guys.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping. And then you know, maybe by the summer, you know, we'll be able to book a bunch of gigs and get out there and play and then finish the album. And yeah, a lot of things going on. And because everything's stagnant now, you know. I've been doing a drum show every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific time for my drum company, and that kept me in shape. I've been doing it for 9 months. We're doing really good with that. Luckily for that, because it makes me practice, you know. Otherwise, yeah. It's easy to sit around and go, well, I'm going to go check my email. And here I'm setting it, the whole thing up. I'm practicing, coming up with new ideas and playing. So it's been a crazy, crazy year.
And you're doing something, because I just got reached out about doing this with you guys. You're doing, you and your brother are doing an interview show, right? A YouTube thing, because they asked me to come on as a guest soon.
Yeah, we're doing that. On Tuesday is my thing, and then on Thursday at 4 p.m., we have a show with Ron Onesti, who owns the Akata Theater in St. Charles, Illinois. Everybody's played there. And he's like the host. And we've had a lot of people on. We had Nick O'McBrain on, just a ton of people, Ted Nugent. And this Thursday, it's Simon Kirk and Kenny Aronoff. And we just sit there and we have a great time. It's a great, we tell stories, you know, we have a great laugh. So we're booking it. Yeah, it'd be great to have you on. It would be lovely. You know,
they booked me. They must have been light. They must have been in a jam for a guest because they booked me for it a couple weeks ago. So I'm going to do it with you guys.
No, but they're trying to book more people down the line, you know, and we're getting a lot of people. We've done a tribute to Eddie Van Halen when he passed, you know, a couple of weeks later. We had about six guitar players on, you know. Did a tribute to Leslie West. We had Corky Lang and Buck Dahmer. It's getting to be really cool, and it's a fun time, and we'd love to have you on the show. That would be so
all you all you musicians trying to become broadcasters during this pandemic. I told each and every one of you, I'm going to learn how to play an instrument. I'm coming for your gig in a year or two. Everybody's got something.
You got to reinvent yourself, you know? Crazy.
Listen, man, I got to run. It's always great talking to you. I hope to see you soon. I hope when travel starts up, I'll catch you out there in L.A. We'll get to hang a little bit. And I appreciate the time, as always. Good talking.
Thank you, Eddie. Good to be here. Good to talk to you. Be safe. And thanks, everybody, for listening to all this great stuff. Funny.
All right, Vin. I'll see you soon, man. I'll talk to you soon. Well, thanks to Vinny. Always great talking with him. And he's out there still playing on a lot of records and doing a great job. And, of course, Last in Line, his current band as well. Thanks earlier to Bill Ward, and thank you for listening. Thanks to Katie Irizarry for producing. I will catch you guys next week for another episode. New episodes every Thursday. Be sure to subscribe to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. And I don't really know how I can top the last 2 weeks. I mean, 3/4 of Original Sabbath and Vinny Appice, tough to do. Drop me a line on social media at Eddie Trunk, and I will catch you again, like I said, next Thursday. Be well, everybody, and I'll catch you then. And hopefully catch you on the radio every day, Sirius XM Volume 106, 2 to 4, 10 to midnight Eastern. Take care.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.